Members, we're going to call the committee to order. And the most important news of the day is that our regular stalwart captain, Jason Chavez, is out sick today.
He was pretty sick yesterday.
He was in pretty bad shape yesterday. In fact, I couldn't hear half the testimony because he sneezed in between the lines. So, but hopefully he's getting some good rest and he'll be back with us soon. But in the meantime, we've got a talented individual who's joining us here today to fill in. And why don't you just quickly introduce yourself so everyone knows who's sitting at the table.
Name is Blake Wilcox. I'm normally CLA for the Housing Committee, so I recognize a few of you members. But thank you for having me, if only for a day.
Well, welcome. Thanks for your help today. Members, I don't think we've got minutes to approve, so we'll wait till the next meeting to do that. And so today we're going to be focusing on mental health issues and criminal justice. And we're going to begin. We've got two bills, they're good, strong bills, but hopefully we'll have enough time to dig into those. But prior to that, we're going to hear a presentation from a local think tank based out of Hamline University here in St. Paul called the Violence Project. And let me just quickly read you a quick description from their website. The Violence Project is a nonpartisan think tank dedicated to reducing violence in society and improving related policy and practice through research and analysis. Our research on mass shootings, funded by the National Institute of Justice, has received global media attention. Our areas of expertise include gun violence, violent extremism, cyber violence, trauma, and mental illness, street gangs, and youth violence. And so, keeping in the spirit of our commitment as a committee to be data information based, and having that constantly before us as we make important decisions about the public safety and community building in our state, I've invited both Dr. Jillian Peterson and Dr. James Densley from the Violence Project to share their thoughts with us here today. Look forward to hearing your testimony and then also for questions and comments from committee members. So welcome both of you doctors to the committee.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So Mr. Chair, members of the committee, sincerely appreciate the opportunity to share our research today. My name is James Densley. I am a sociologist by training. I'm a professor of criminal justice at Metropolitan State University and a co-founder of the Violence Project.
And I am Jillian Peterson. I'm a professor of criminal justice at Hamline University, and I'm a psychologist by training. So my area of focus for the last decade or so has been the intersection of mental health and mental illness in the criminal justice system.
So we have a collaborative effort with the University of Minnesota then and Hamline University. So yes. I stand corrected, but again, I welcome you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we're going to talk a little bit about some of the research that we've been doing over the last few years, both on sort of broadly mental illness in the criminal justice system and then specifically on mass shootings. So just as some context, some background, the criminalization of mental illness refers to the period of time after the 50s and the 60s when we deinstitutionalized in this country. We closed most of the large psychiatric institutions with the goal of people receiving community-based mental health services. Unfortunately, those were never really put into place. So criminalization of mental illness is the idea that the criminal justice system became the institution that can't say no. It became the institution that kind of took up the slack and started doing a lot of the mental health treatment in this country. Police became known as street corner psychiatrists. Mercy arrests were very common in the 90s and early 2000s, which were police officers arresting people in order to secure them treatment, because that was the sort of fastest and easiest way to get someone treatment if they needed it. And currently in this country, people with serious and persistent mental illness are four times more likely to be arrested for minor crimes than people without mental illness. So that would be things like dining and dashing, public urination. And as a result of this, the three largest mental health treatment providers in this country are all jails. So it's the LA County Jail, Rikers Island, and the Cook County Jail. The largest treatment provider of mental health services in the state of Minnesota is the Hennepin County Jail. They treat 200 to 300 inmates per day versus the largest psychiatric hospital in Minnesota has 115 beds. So they are doing 2 to 3 times the amount of treatment. And of course, jails and prisons were not designed to be mental health treatment centers, and they're not funded to be mental health treatment centers. This becomes a revolving door. So the problem was when police were arresting people in order to get them services, once you enter the criminal justice system, most people never leave. So our national recidivism rates, we know, are 68 to 77%. For people with serious mental illness, it's twice that high. They almost always go back once they've been in prison. People with serious mental illness are likely to have longer sentences. They are more likely to be sent to solitary. They're more likely to be victimized. They're more likely to serve their maximum sentence. They're more likely to fail on parole or probation for technical violations, and they're more likely to return to custody than people without mental illness. And we do a lot of talking to people for research at police, corrections, probation and parole, anyone we talk to, and we say kind of what is the issue in criminal justice right now. People say it's mental illness that is completely overwhelming the system. We know that there are significant barriers to treatment in the community. There's a lack of knowledge, there's a lack of resources, there's a lack of accessibility. There's sometimes a lack of motivation. Sometimes it's complex because it also involves poverty or homelessness or substance use. We know that the police are really on the front lines of this problem, that we've seen crisis calls across the state really skyrocket in the recent years, and that when police get on the scene, they really have very few options in their tool belt. They can arrest, they can hospitalize on a 72-hour hold, or they can walk away. When we spent time at a couple of local hospitals, we found that 80% of people that came to the hospital on a hold from the police were turned around and were at home within hours because the hospitals don't have the beds to take them in. So people were taking an ambulance ride there and turning right back around and sometimes calling the police again. So we know that this system is not working. And that police really need more resources. And a lot of times police are just not the right people to be handling a mental health crisis. And then to further complicate this, we know that people with serious mental illness are 16 times more likely to be shot and killed by police, which leads to headlines like think twice before calling the cops on the mentally ill. And this is, when we've talked to people in the community, a serious concern that if they call police on their family members, there's the possibility of it escalating into serious violence. So one, we really started researching mass shootings because this was a place where the relationship between mental illness and violence was getting a lot of coverage. People talk about mental illness and mass shootings, and we had no data around how often do perpetrators of mass shootings have a mental illness? What's the diagnosis? Are they taking medication? The data just didn't exist. So we started building this database, and we got a large grant from the U.S. Department of Justice to support the work. It's a database of 171 mass shooters, and they're coded on over 100 pieces of life history information. And as part of this research, we've also been interviewing perpetrators of mass shootings who are incarcerated. We've met their parents, their siblings, their old teachers, their social workers, trying to understand what is the life history here, what's the life story, so that we can do more to prevent it. And when it comes to mass shootings, our current approaches, our public safety models, are really focused on minimizing casualties. So how do we sort of create stronger doors? How do we create secure entrances? How do we train ourselves to run, hide, and fight? How do we do things assuming it's going to happen? How do we minimize the casualties? The goal of this research was to understand where is this coming from in the first place so that we can really cut it off before it starts. We also know that for the past 20 years, we have been doing things like active shooter drills and billions of dollars on security, and it's not working. So mass shootings are getting deadlier and they are getting more frequent. The worst year on record was 2019. The worst year before that was 2018. The worst year before that was 2017. So this is not a problem that we have figured out. Our model that we put together, so this is based on both the database research and also our interviews with perpetrators and their families, we see this really common pathway in the lives of perpetrators of mass shootings. So almost everyone starts out experiencing early childhood trauma, abuse, significant exposure to violence at an early age. We see that develop into a clear crisis point. People communicate this crisis, people notice this crisis. 80% of the time, we can say that this individual was in an active crisis in the days, weeks, and months prior to the shooting, and they also become actively suicidal. So mass shootings are nearly always suicides as well as homicides. Then script invalidation, which is shooters study other shooters. They learn how to do this. They get radicalized in online hate groups. And then finally, access and ability, so the ability to enter the place that you've chosen and access to weapons. We see that a lot of our prevention efforts right now are focused on access and ability, and there's actually a lot more opportunity that we could be taking when it comes to trauma, especially crisis and suicidality. So this is just some examples. These are words of perpetrators themselves from our interviews with them about severe physical abuse, severe sexual abuse early in life. If we look at the mental health backgrounds of perpetrators of mass shootings, it's about two-thirds. You can identify some sort of mental health history. In the general population, it's about 50% of people have some sort of mental health history. So it's higher, not significantly higher. Thought disorder, though, you do see 26% of mass shooters have a thought disorder. That's 1% in the general population. And you can see criminal record, very common, violent history, very common, and then almost all the time in a crisis state. And then we also see that suicidality both before the shooting, so expressing thoughts of suicide, and then also during this shooting. So many perpetrators kill themselves during the shooting. Another big finding was that perpetrators of mass shootings are insiders. So school shooters are almost always students of that school. Workplace shooters are almost always employees of that workplace. A lot of the policies that we've put in place assume that they're outsiders, that we can protect ourselves with security, that we can train ourselves to respond, when in reality, the perpetrators are running through the training, the same training. They go in and out of those entrances every day, and they know exactly how everyone is going to respond. So when you are working with an insider threat, it's a really kind of different phenomenon. And then also nearly 80% of school mass shooters and also many sort of other types of mass shooters leak their plans ahead of time. 80% of the time, perpetrators are telling other people that they're going to do this. They're posting it online. They're talking about it. And we see that as a real opportunity. Currently, what we have is a criminal justice response to that. So we come in and we arrest or we expel or we criminally charge. But when you're dealing with someone who is actively suicidal and in crisis, it may not be the best response. It can actually increase the grievance and increase the likelihood of violence.
So what does this mean for prevention? What does it mean for policy? What our data is suggesting is that you don't necessarily have to be mentally ill to perpetrate an act of mass violence, but you're certainly not mentally well when you do so. And understanding this feeds into our need for reform within our mental health system and changes to the way in which we go about doing business. Some examples of strategies which are very common, where a lot of people put their time and resources, but our data are suggesting are perhaps not having the impact that we would hope, are in, for example, active shooter drills, when you think about perpetrators being insiders and not outsiders and the implications that that has, particularly when you think about the mental health of the young children who may be going through those active shooter drills in a school environment. We put the next one and we called it Waiting for Superman. But I think it's this idea that any one of these issues is exclusively a law enforcement problem, that we can police our way out of this. But as we mentioned at the beginning of this presentation, this conversation, that's not the case, because the police aren't well-resourced, well-trained, or necessarily best positioned to be the people who are doing this type of work. If the perpetrators of these types of events are insiders, that means we need to be more attuned to what their needs are from the inside. They're our colleagues at work. They're our kids in our schools. And so having the outside influence of law enforcement may not necessarily be the best solution. Armed security may seem like an intuitive suggestion, and in the event that a terrible tragedy like a mass shooting is occurring at this very moment, then yes, you want armed security on the scene. But think about from the perspective of someone who is in a suicidal crisis. If they know that armed security is going to show up and try and neutralize that threat, that might be the intention. We know a lot about suicide by cop, for instance. We know a lot about the use of force scenarios that people in a mental health crisis find themselves in. It changes the way in which we think about these events. And then finally, punishing threats. If somebody is threatening, that's an opportunity for intervention. You can call it a cry for help if you would like. But often our response to threats are to criminalize that person, to put them through the criminal justice system, to exacerbate the grievances that they have with where it is they have the grievance, if it's at the workplace or if it's at the school, but we exclude them or we fire them or we call the cops on them, that's only going to make things worse. So we have to ask ourselves, what are we doing to support those individuals at that time? So here are some suggestions of things that perhaps we could fund or prioritize or at least incorporate into our daily routines. First is around creating a culture of care and inclusivity within our workplaces, within our schools, and within our communities. This relates to things like social and emotional learning, which you look at this here and think, well, we're here at a public safety committee meeting. What has social and emotional learning and creating a culture of care got to do with public safety? My answer to that is everything. You have to understand that these are steps to improve public safety if you can eliminate some of those grievances and get people the support they need within their workplace and school environments. And there's lots of models of this throughout the country, some examples on the slide here. The second thing, Jillian says this a lot, and I'm going to steal it from her, which is she's a big believer that crisis intervention, de-escalation, and suicide prevention are skills a lot like CPR. It's something that we can all be trained in. It's something that we can all be attuned to. It's something that we can all be part of. So we think funding within schools, crisis intervention training, for example, doing more work around suicide prevention, and making this a priority within our communities is a huge part of public safety and addressing mental health challenges. Another thing that could be done is often we have this sort of mantra of if you see something, say something, but people often don't know who to say anything to. And then once you've said something, nobody does anything because the lines of communication are unclear. There are examples of statewide crisis intervention centers, anonymous reporting systems, akin to a suicide prevention hotline, which could be funded on a statewide level here in Minnesota, that people could plug into to not just report others who they see as threatening, but who are in a legitimate mental health crisis. Or you can self-report to get the support you need. This is not a criminal justice response so that you become sort of penalized for this. This is an off-ramp so we can get you the support that you need. We've done a lot of work, both in terms of research and practice, around implementing intervention teams within workplaces, schools, and also working with law enforcement about how to do this type of work. We call this the R model. Which is research, respond, and refer. But it basically is a protocol for thinking about how we would go about this in practice. Now, I highlight this because we went through the R model with a police department right here in Minnesota, and we've worked with other police departments since. But they saw a massive increase in their crisis calls. You can see the chart on the slide here. The line that's pointing up was their crisis calls over the last 10 or 15 years, and they were exponentially increasing. And at the same time, officers were very frustrated by the fact that they seemed to have only these three options in their tool belt, which is that they could either arrest somebody, but no crime had been committed. They could hospitalize somebody, but they weren't necessarily a threat to self or others, and they'd be turned immediately around by the hospital once they got there. Or they'd be forced to walk away, and that was it. And they were feeling that that was not a satisfactory outcome. Not to mention all the other challenges of being put in an ambulance and the costs associated with that if people don't have adequate healthcare and insurance and other things as well. So what we tried to do working with that police department was identifying what resources were available in that community that people could be referred to in addition to those three options. We also did crisis intervention and de-escalation training for the police department. And we worked on other protocols in terms of their training processes and other things over the course of a year. In so doing, we saw a 23% decline in crisis calls, particularly in repeat callers, after we did this intervention. This was with the Minnetonka Police Department here in Minnesota. And it demonstrates, I think, that if you're working in partnership to be thinking more strategically and holistically about mental health in the community, you can realize that the police are part of this solution, but they're not the only part of the solution, and we have to identify where those connections are. So the key takeaways from all this is that we need to be data-driven in examining what is working and what is not. We need to be able to much more attuned to spotting the signs of a crisis and then intervening with resources rather than punishment. And in order to achieve that, we all need to be trained in this sort of crisis intervention model. And we need to create positive cultures in our workplaces, in our schools, in our communities, strong relationships, and good access to mental health resources. Recognizing that those things may not feel like or sound like public safety, but it really, really is. Thank you.
Thank you both for your testimony today. Members and for people in the, or citizens in the public, this PowerPoint is available on our committee website, and so I would encourage you to go visit our website to review some of the data shared here today. I'm just wondering very quickly, and you referenced at the very end Minnetonka, for instance. Does the Violence Project, or is there a centralized place where legislators, regular citizens can go and visit to review evaluations of efforts? I take it that you're, you know, the few that you've highlighted are based not only on programs that are following certain elements identified, you know, in this rubric, but perhaps also programs that have been around for a little while, so that there's some objective analysis of how successful they've been. So if you can share anything along those lines, I'd appreciate it.
Sure, yeah. I mean, there are some sort of clearinghouses for this type of information online. The federal government, the National Institute of Justice, for example, has one for criminal justice best practices. I'm sure you may be familiar with them, but they code them almost like a traffic light, you know, red for things that don't work, yellow for things that are, you know, promising, green for things that have been proven effective. But we have talked about this a lot, about perhaps having the need for a statewide Minnesota clearinghouse on where can you get good training in things like crisis intervention, or where can you sort of understand what the best practices are, and who are the providers in Minnesota that have been sort of approved and evaluated and other things. Creating that would, I think, be a huge benefit to the public. Now, with regard to the R model and the work we did with Minnetonka, that particular thing is published in a peer-reviewed journal. It's called the Police Journal. The evaluation that was conducted there was a sort of before, during, and after design for the evaluation. So that is out there. It's on our website, and you know, we can certainly share with the committee if people are interested in that work as well. I don't know if you have anything more on than that.
No, I think we definitely need some sort of hub, I think, of information. And it tends to be sort of schools have their kind of model, you know, police have this, workplace this, but it really all is looking at the same thing, crisis intervention, de-escalation, suicide prevention, some sort of centralized place where people could go. We know churches are wanting this training. We've talked to hotel staff that want this training. We've talked to city government who's like, we have people in crisis all the time. We need this training. So some place that people could go and have access, I think, would be really helpful.
Oh, very well. I had another quick question. It just went right out of my head. But that's okay. I have several members who have questions. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On Friday, I went up to Camp Ripley for the day, and I was invited up by the Chief of Police Association, served on a panel with Senator Latz. And the vast majority of the time of the questions that they had, the concerns they had from Chief of Police folks from all over the state, mostly from greater Minnesota and from smaller agencies, but not exclusively, was exactly what they're talking about, the mental health crisis, having no place to take anybody, and having very little tools available. So this is a room full of chiefs and deputy chiefs and deputy sheriffs and chief, I don't know, a whole room full of people that really are on the front lines and as frustrated as all can be. And they literally, by the time we were done, I said, yes, we have a mental health crisis. Yes, we closed the state hospitals. And nope, we didn't create the community-based care that we said we were going to do. And they said, can you please get on the HHS committee and fix that? I'm on 7 now, so no. But but it was something that they were so adamant, and it was such a daily part of their lives. And one thing that we've tried to accomplish in my area anyway is to have a crisis response team. And so I wanted to bring that up and see if you've seen other places in Minnesota or across the nation that have done specific crisis response teams that are multidisciplined folks, not just law enforcement, but the whole breadth of it. So they can actually respond and kind of, it's almost like a social worker kind of idea and pull them through the whole process and help them to get care. And yes, I know we need more community support, but at least the support we have and the services we have, they could connect them. So is that something that you've looked at and talked to people about in the community response
team? Dr. Peterson.
Yeah, it is. So the sometimes people call it a co-responder model, or having really an in-house social worker or mental health provider that can, when you go on a crisis call, when someone's in crisis, that's not the time to hook them up with treatment. You're just trying to keep them alive and okay. It's time to get them back to equilibrium. If you can follow up with that person a day or two later, not with the police knocking on their door, but some sort of social worker saying, hey, what do you need? Where are the resources? Here's what we can hook you into. I think that'd be really helpful. We did find when we were doing this research, for example, crisis response teams, they were there, but their response time was 2 hours, and so police couldn't wait that long. But if we facilitated a conversation between those two teams and said, could you get someone stabilized, call and check in, knowing they're going to show up, we also found that there was a community mental health center that had same-day crisis appointments, but the police had never heard of them. And so once the police knew that, they could bring someone there and drop them off. A lot of times it was kind of seeing what's available in the community and then how do you start those conversations, because it's no one's real job to cross over those boundaries and to create those connections.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I know that Sherburne County, Stearns County, Wright County, I believe they are the coalition that has this crisis response team. I don't know what their response time is, yep. But are you seeing that pervasively across Minnesota, or is that like a unique thing to just my area?
It's coming, but I think it's still fairly unique. So St. Paul has a mental health unit that's been really effective. We know that there's some kind of first-ring suburbs that are starting to hire in-house social workers. I think this movement is coming. But I would not say it's pervasive at this point.
Something we can work on, Mr. Chair.
Indeed, Representative O'Neill, it's a big agenda, should be a big agenda for us. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Professor Peterson and Professor Demsley. I'm looking at the chart that's on 13, and I'm curious, what is a thought disorder? And then my next follow-up is, you know, you had mentioned that nearly 100% of people that do this are in some type of crisis or some type of mental illness, going through something. At the same time, this is a very, very, very small portion of people that deal with mental illness. If you could just speak to that, that would be great. Sure.
Yeah, so it's an important question. So the vast, vast majority of people with serious and persistent mental illness are never violent. You're more likely to be a victim than commit a violent crime. And so we don't want to blend those lines. Certainly mental illness is not a risk factor for violence. In this population of people who perpetrate mass shootings, we do see thought disorders, which I would call kind of schizophrenia spectrum disorders, hallucinations, and delusions. Now, sometimes we make the mistake of saying, because you have a mental illness, therefore your crime was committed because of that mental illness. It's not like if you have depression, everything you do in your life is because you have depression. So we also look carefully at what percentage of the crimes were really motivated directly by that mental illness, and it's only about 16%. So about 16% of mass shootings, the person was in kind of an active psychotic state, which means in 84% of them, that wasn't the case.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Dean. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, to the testifiers, thank you for being here. Some very good information. And I'm glad the testifier brought up the fact that the 72-hour holds are only for those who are going to harm themselves or others. And that hold only gets them into the door of the facility. Once they do the evaluation, if everything checks out, they open the door and let them out. If there is a problem, they can hold them for up to 72 hours before they have to go to court to hold them longer. And you gave some fascinating information. In the law enforcement field, we are just frustrated. As you said, we only have three options. In greater Minnesota, where it's smaller departments, the response team sounds great, but the funds aren't there to do them. They don't have the facilities to do them. In fact, I just happened to run across an article in online today when I was preparing for this hearing. Back in 1950, we had 337 beds for every 100,000 people in Minnesota. The current average across the country right now, or actually the recommended, is 40 to 60 beds per 100,000 people. The national average is 11.7 beds. And unfortunately, Minnesota is dead last at 3.7 beds for every 100,000 people. We're about 50 beds short per 100,000 people in the state. And in the law enforcement field, we're really frustrated because we had the three options. A lot of times, we're dealing with the same person every 4 to 5 months. We'd deal with them, get them the assistance they need, get them back on their medications. They'd be released from where they were. 2 months later, they'd get off their medications, and 2 weeks later, we're dealing with them again. It's a vicious cycle over and over and over again. And unfortunately, it's frustrating for law enforcement as well, because we don't want them taking up our jail facilities. It's not where they belong. But we have there is another place for them because they can be a danger to themselves or others. And sometimes it's the only place they're going to get a warm bed and three square meals. The frustrating thing for us is the lack of beds, the lack of space to bring them, to get them the help they need. And unfortunately, in the last few years, Health and Human Services has even closed more beds. This is an issue that law enforcement has to deal with, but it's an issue that needs to be dealt with in Health and Human Services. They need to provide the space and the beds and the things we need for these people, but they're not doing that. And as we've seen in the press this last year, all the waste, fraud, and abuse going on in that department, and nothing's getting done about it. I'd hate to find out how much money that we could use for programs like this would be available if we did a forensic audit of all those departments, and we could probably actually open up the 337 beds again, which we don't need. But we need to do something because we need to help these people, because they deserve the help they need.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. That, quite frankly, I couldn't agree with you more. Why I worked awfully hard to make sure that we structured our conversation last year and this year on community-centered public safety. What I'm hearing from the testimony is I was struck by, and we've heard this before, Chair Constant, and I, we heard this from your public safety chief, Chief Miller, if I remember correctly, who's a national and international expert on this issue, that police are part of the solution, but not the only part of the solution. And so that begs the whole community framework for being able to be present, particularly when people are in crisis. And if we're not present, then the price that we pay is just a horrific price. And, you know, Representative Johnson, beds cost money. And so part of what we have to do is the very tough work of making sure that we smartly collect the resources of the people and smartly apply them. But we have to have the will to collect those resources in order to put them to goodwill, to good purpose, rather. And so I hope that this committee can be a strong voice to make sure that the state has the resources to be able to fund the ability for us to have these crisis intervention, if you will, and infrastructure available for Minnesotans. I have a question related to that, and feel free also to comment, and Representative Johnson's. But so it's one thing to have beds and to hold people. It seems to me the real issue beyond that is, what do you do with folks when you have them? I mean, clearly, someone who's a danger to him or herself in the public, should be in a safe place away from the public. But it seems to me there's an opportunity there then to do something other than just to hold them. And I hate for us to continue that cycle of holding, doing nothing, and then releasing back. So maybe just very quickly, what are best practices about what you do when you're intervening in crisis and you're holding someone for a period of time?
Yeah, I think holds are not sort of healing mental health treatment, right? You hold someone because you don't want them to die and you don't want them to hurt somebody else, and you're trying to get them through that moment. That's that crisis moment. They're kind of at a red hot crisis and you want to get them down to here so they're not going to hurt anyone. But you really need then long-term intervention and long-term access to community care. Ideally, every person who is sort of suffering from a mental health disorder would have another number to call other than 911 when they feel themselves getting into crisis, whether that's their own therapist or whether that's a social worker, or whether that's a crisis line, or whether they'd be able to recognize those symptoms and have another number to call. Most people don't have that number. Most people, it's 911 or nothing. And so the more that we can connect people to long-term, accessible, affordable community mental health care, I think the better. Certainly sometimes people have to be held. They just have to be. But then after that, how do you make sure that the systems are in place and the resources are available for long-term access? We know this is a particular problem in rural parts of Minnesota. I did a training at a high school not long ago, and they said, you know, two-thirds of our students really could use mental health care, but the nearest provider is an hour away and no one can afford the gas. So in that case, it was sort of like, I don't know what to tell you. So part of it is just the community resources aren't there.
Huge challenge for good parts of greater Minnesota, absolutely. Yeah. Representative Johnson, you have a follow-up? Then I'm going to call on Chair Considine, and then we're going to move to the bills.
Just a little follow-up, Chair Mariani. And she touched on as well the lack of availability of the care in some areas of the state. But unless, and the other tough part is unless the person is institutionalized, there's that, if they don't want the care, we can, it cannot be forced upon them.
Chair Considine, and then I didn't see you represent Miller, so you'll close this out with questions or thoughts. Chair Considine.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. First, I'm kind of curious if you are familiar with the program going on in Mankato before the L line. Nope. They've actually put
the
a...
Nodding of the head doesn't happen on the... Huh? On the record, so I'll note that.
Sorry.
They've actually put a social worker in the booking room. And prior to booking, they are doing an assessment and trying to divert them before they're even booked. And that's one of the more positive, I think, programs that I've heard about recently. Obviously, there are some people, even if they come back, they still have to book them, but if they're not actually acting out, they're taking them and getting them wraparound services, and they're not going into jail, which I kind of like. Also, Chair Mariani mentioned I chair the correctional reform, and we started delving into the mental health services in the prison. I believe the Department of Corrections is doing the best they can, but they're woefully inadequate, and we have started a planning committee that my committee administrator likes to refer to as a moonshot, but he didn't hear me. He's not paying attention. Okay. I would like to maybe get a chance to talk to you about that a little bit, maybe get some ideas. As we were looking in this over the summer and the fall, it was so overwhelming that that's why we came up with a planning committee or commission to start looking at these things. We don't have enough treatment. We don't have enough mental health counselors. We don't have enough assessments to determine who needs them. It's a terrible situation. So at some point, I'd like to connect with you and see if you guys have some ideas. Thank you.
I was just going to say yes. I mean, the idea of a planning committee speaking to this idea that it has to be kind of interdisciplinary, if you will. That you have to recognize that this issue is not just a policing issue. It's not just a corrections issue. It's not just a health and human services type issue. It's across the board. And I think doing it in that way is smart. And just to sort of piggyback off of the other earlier comments, I think the challenges that we have is that, you know, 911 is the only number you can call where you can't say no. Whereas there's so many barriers when you call everywhere else. You know, it's, I need to see a doctor. Well, they're not in today. Can you afford them? They don't take your insurance. Can you be on the waiting list? You know, whereas you call 911, at least you know someone's going to show up. And I think we have to figure out having a service or some way of connecting people where that number, not 911, also can't say no, and gets you to a point where you can start to be connected to the people and the services that you need.
And I would just add, I like that you mentioned wraparound services, because I think sometimes we get hooked on this has to be mental health treatment. You can, you know, if you're homeless, you know, yet still a risk factor. If you have a substance abuse disorder, if you don't have a job, if you're in a dangerous relationship, I think these are complicated cases, and it's about figuring out for that person what are all the services that they need, not just mental health.
Exactly. Thank you for your availability to us as a resource, and I encourage members from both sides of the aisle, all sides of the aisle, to avail themselves of you. Representative Mueller, you get the last question and comments here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had the opportunity to attend the full-day training that you offered, and it was really good, and you've done just a great job in presenting both our Education Policy Committee and now today really trying to focus in on what's relevant to our committees. So thank you. You're in very high demand around the country right now, so we appreciate your time here. I had a question similar to Representative Dean's question about that same slide that's up right now, and I've been wondering as I've heard you presenting And I appreciate so much, Dr. Peterson, that you said mental illness is not a risk factor for violence. My question has to do with personality disorders, and if you look at that factor too, and how that maybe fits into this slide.
So we started trying to code personality disorders, and we actually gave up because the database is built using publicly available information, and those are that's really hard to get at with publicly available documents. And I should say the same thing for this mental illness information. It's what's publicly available. So I would love to have my hands on all the records of everyone who's ever done this, but it's, I think personality disorders are in particularly hard to kind of code from media exposure and things. So we don't know.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Well, and again, thank you, Drs. Peterson and Desley. Thank you for the work that you do, for providing us with database views of reality and of suggestions of how we can better design our policy and practices in our state to make to help make our state a safer place. So.
Thank you.
Look forward to our continued conversation.
Thank you very much. You.
Very well. Members, we're going to switch up the bills. Representative Edelson, in a spirit of wonderful collegiality, has asked Representative Munson to go forward first, since he's not a member of this committee, and so I think it's a good, respectful use of his time. So, Representative Munson, if you can come forward. And Representative Miller, I believe you have a motion before us.
I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I move that House File 1864 be considered for inclusion in a possible future public safety omnibus bill. That's the way you want me to say it.
I'll adjust it a little bit. Representative Miller moves that House File 1864 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. We will be laying this over, and so that. And that brings in your other thought about
that was my misunderstanding. I thought it was going to be laid over. So, okay, thank you.
All right, very well. And then, Representative Miller, there is an A1 amendment, if you would be so kind to move that as well.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I would also move the A1 amendment to House File 1864.
Very well. Discussion on the A1 amendment. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
All same sign. Very well. Representative Munson, House File 1864, as amended, is before us.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Miller for moving it. Members of the committee, this bill, House File 1864, also known as Cassie's Law, will help hopefully address a gap we have in our sentencing for people with mental illness. We have a very compelling story from Mr. Berry that you'll hear from shortly about Cassie, but this really impacts quite a few people in the state who are convicted of crimes and then sentenced when they have a brain injury or a stroke that can that may have caused issues with during their crime that needs to be addressed. And really this comes down to allowing defendants to have a neuropsychological exam that could have impacted their crime, so the judge can take that into consideration upon sentencing. And this also helps with the inequity of people coming from different economic backgrounds, whereas some people that are convicted may have the means to afford a neuropsychological exam, and those who don't may end up in the wrong place and not get the necessary treatment or have sentencing that is not appropriate for them. So if members would allow, Mr. Berry, would you like to present your testimony?
Very well. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Berry. Good to see you as always.
Thank you, Chairman Mariani, and members of the committee. I thank you for having me here, and a lot of you have heard the story. My name is Tim Berry. I live in Fergus Falls, Minnesota. It's been 6 years now that I've been fighting to save my daughter's life after her massive frontal lobe stroke. It was 2 years ago in April that I walked across the state carrying this sign. I walked about 200 miles before that big snowstorm hit, thinking that I need to save my daughter's life. For the past 6 years, my daughter Cassandra, after her massive stroke, has been in jails and prisons because she has such massive frontal lobe damage that she has no sense of consequence, no sense of, she has no impulse control. So I'm here today to talk about my daughter, Cassandra, who 6 years ago had a massive frontal lobe stroke due to complications of a hernia operation, a month after her oldest daughter, Araya, was born. Growing up, Cassie was a fun child. She was smart. She was kind. At 15, she was diagnosed bipolar. Bipolar turned into self-medicating. At 26, she had a massive stroke, which the doctors told me that they didn't even know if she would recover from. Since that stroke, I've been, I don't want to use the term fighting, but I have been fighting to save my daughter's life with the Department of Human Services, with anybody that would listen in this state. My daughter spends most of her time in solitary confinement at the women's prison in Shakopee. The damage the stroke did to her brain is beyond my comprehension. Her frontal lobe was destroyed, and with it, her sense of consequence and inhibition control. The daughter I have now is not the daughter I had before. The complications of the stroke have led her to prison without the help that she's needed from different departments in this state. My son, I brought my son with me today. He can tell you that his sister is gone. The sister that he grew up with no longer exists. And the only help we have for her in this state seems to be jails and prisons. My daughter was arrested and sent through the court system without any help and recognition of her stroke and the effects of her stroke. Public defenders, county attorneys told me we have a Rule 20. These public defenders and county attorneys told me, Rule 20s, you're not going to sit in a jail cell for 15 minutes and diagnose the stroke and the effects of the stroke. But that's what the criminal justice system relies on. 15 minutes sitting in a jail cell talking with somebody. And that's a diagnosis that you're going to get with a stroke. That's why I had to pay for a neuropsychological examination for my daughter, which cost me $3,500. That was 2 years ago. It cost me $3,500. They took it to the court. The judge says, yeah, I gotcha. I understand. Not a thing I could do. Sent my daughter back to prison for 2 more years for a probation violation, in essence. Just like the presenters that were here before, they were spot on everything they were saying. I spoke with Representative Johnson last week, and what he was saying just now about the Department of Human Services, that's where the problem lies. When I have a commissioner from the Department of Human Services tell me, Tim, I am sorry, your daughter fell through our safety net. I said, Claire, what safety net? She says, I know, there is none. And yet my daughter goes back to prison. When I have commissioners telling me that. When I have Department of Human Services employees telling me, Tim, your daughter is a poster child for a broken system. And the Department of Human Services employees telling me this, there is a huge problem. I could go on forever. Please help people with brain injuries and strokes receive the tests and get the care and treatment that they need. You have an example of Cassie's neuropsychological exam before you, which explicitly identifies treatment options that would help her manage and deal with her behaviors long term. This document, written by a medical professional, found that Cassie does not present an imminent risk to others and recommends treatment options that could have helped her stay with her family and out of prison. This is who we're talking about. This is my daughter. On the day that I got her out of jail to go and have a neuropsychological exam. This is what we have in solitary confinement. This is the person we have in the women's prison. She's not the only one affected. These are her two daughters that no longer have a mother. The little one I picked up in prison 3 years ago. Is that the best Minnesota has? Is that the best we can do in the state of Minnesota? Minnesota used to be, they used to call it the Minnesota model for treatment. I'm not seeing it. I am not seeing it. When little girls suffer, and we have a girl sitting in solitary confinement with half a brain, no leg, because she got, during the stroke, a clot went to her leg and they cut her leg off. So she woke up 3 months later in the hospital bed with half a brain, no leg, and a new baby girl. Ever since that time, she has been in jail and prison. Perhaps a treatment center not meant for stroke and bipolar and addiction, but they just throw her in a treatment center just to say they put her in a treatment center, which she fails because it is not designed for stroke, bipolar, and addiction. Is this the best Minnesota has? I pray to God it's not. We believe that the neuropsychological exam can help judges make decisions that uplift people and allow them to get treatment options when possible rather than being funneled into prison. Thank you for listening, and I ask for your support in House File 1864.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Berry. You do your honor, your daughter, tremendous honor, and as a parent, myself, and I suspect most, if not all, our committee members are parents. We can only begin to imagine the trauma and the hurt that you and your family have experienced. I believe that we can do better, and we're going to work awfully hard to do a lot better. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Munson, you have other testifiers, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, and I also just want to mention that the amendment that was adopted also not just addresses people with traumatic brain injury and stroke, but also includes those with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, another significant group of people who fall through the sentencing cracks here in the judicial system in Minnesota.
Absolutely, Representative Munson. That's a good. Yep. It was good. I moved pretty quickly, we didn't have a chance to identify that addition. So thank you for doing that. I'm going to ask our testifiers to be as brief as they can because I do want to get to the other bill, but I do want to honor your presence and your words here today. So please welcome to the committee and state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is April Ilvad, and I am a mental health practitioner with Advanced Behavioral Health. My specialty is in treating people with brain injuries and significant mental health disorders and developmental disabilities. I also have a brain injury myself, so I come at this from a very personal perspective. I'm here to speak to you today about the dangers of the criminal justice system being a revolving door for people with brain injuries. I have two clients that I'd like to speak to you about today. One is that The first client that I would like to talk about is a male. He was hit in the head by his female housemate after asking her to move out. This resulted in a traumatic brain injury. She had stolen his identity a couple of times and refused to move out of his house several times. The hit in the head caused the brain injury, which also caused him to have difficulties regulating his emotions and being able to handle stressful situations like asking her to move out of his house. A year after the assault, he requested her to move out again and ended up getting into a large verbal argument with her. The police were called, and he was arrested and charged with a verbal assault. He went to court, and the public defender did not bring up his brain injury. He does not have a neuropsych evaluation on file. The judge charged him with the verbal assault, and now he has a misdemeanor charge on his file. If he had the neuropsych evaluation, it would have shown the deficits that he has. The second client that I like to talk about has the inability to control his anger and has been so angry he has become physically violent with others. Due to having the neuropsych reports on file, after the assault, he was not charged, and he was encouraged to receive further psychological evaluations and treatments. With these treatments and the added services, they've led to better outcomes for this client, and he has actually been able to control his emotions a little bit better and able to recognize when he is getting angry and be able to control that a little bit more. The biggest differences between these two cases are that my second client has the neuropsych report on file, and his brain injury is evident. My first client, his brain injury is not evident. He acts and he looks normal. Having the neuropsychological exam on file may have saved taxpayer money with the courts, within the courts, and the public defender. So I'm here asking you to support House File 1864 to better help support people with brain injuries when they come into the court system. Thank you.
Thank you. And I want to make sure can you spell your name for the record? Because I'm not sure I got it right. So.
Yes, thank you for asking. It's ILDVAD.
Fantastic. What a great name.
Thank you. Thank you. Very unique.
Yes, it is. Thank you for your testimony.
There's only eight of us in the United States with that name.
Where from?
Denmark.
Denmark.
Yeah.
Very well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Messelt, and I'm the Executive Director of Proof Alliance, formerly the Minnesota Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 1864. FASD, fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, occur when alcohol is consumed during pregnancy. It causes permanent brain injuries. These conditions are lifelong and irreversible. Individuals with an FASD are involved with the justice system at an alarming rate. People with FASD often have a form of brain injury that makes it difficult for them to stay out of trouble with the law. In fact, MOFAS, now Proof Alliance, was founded by former First Lady Susan Carlson, who, as a Hennepin County juvenile court referee, observed in the 1990s in her courtroom that many of the repeat offenders had FASD. They were not responding to her sentences, not learning from their experiences. The same kids were coming through her courtroom over and over and over again. After extensive research, she realized that the youth with FASD were coming through her courtroom had much better outcomes if she applied punishment with the lens of understanding that someone with FASD often has impulse control, inability to understand consequences of current behavior, had difficult planning and connecting cause and effect. With these sentences, addressing the underlying brain injury kept the kids out of the court, kept them in school, and improved outcomes. I have listened to hundreds of parents and caregivers in the over two decades I have worked at Proof Alliance. Interactions with the judicial system are literally often the straw that breaks the family apart. Lack of information for our judicial professionals can perpetuate poor outcomes and does nothing to keep our communities safe. I have heard from many people with an FASD that they do not want FASD to be seen as an excuse for why a law is broken, but they do want people to understand that it can often be a reason. This bill goes far to address the complex issues facing people with brain injury and will help to promote more effective, cost-effective outcomes for us all. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Messel. Thank you for shedding some light on FASD for us here today. Are there any anything else for testifiers? I think you're good.
No, Mr. Chair. I just want to just sum up by saying that this we're not asking for a get out of jail free card for people just because they have a brain injury. Somebody that slips and fell on the ice when they were 15, that's not an excuse why they embezzled $50 million when they're 50. It's just an extra tool that the judges can take into consideration upon sentencing, and I think this will go a long way to help people with brain injuries and fetal alcohol syndrome disorder.
Very good bill, Representative Munson. There are some questions from committee members, Representative Nash, Considine, and Pinto, and then we'll move forward from there. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author, our testifiers, or some of our many lawyers in the room, why aren't we doing this before sentencing? That seems kind of a dumb idea that we're waiting for someone to be sentenced and then we're going to go look at this. Why wouldn't we look at this in advance of that? So that as we're entering that phase, we could know more. I'm just confused. And then follow up as you're thinking about it is just because I would be interested in a fiscal note, what that looks like as well.
Very well, Representative
Munson. Yeah. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Nash. There is a fiscal cost. Roughly about $1,800 to $2,400 is the average neuropsychological exam. Keep in mind it costs about $41,000 a year to incarcerate an inmate here in Minnesota. If sentencing would be less or different, it may make up for those costs. But we're very aware. I've requested a fiscal note, of course, not at the state level, but at the local level, to see what the cost would be. The honest truth is we don't know how many people this would impact. And having a neuropsychological exam ordered after conviction and before sentencing is likely going to significantly reduce the cost because there would be less people that it would be called for, since some people may not be convicted in the first place. But I have Zach from the Brain Injury Alliance to testify to maybe more detail in your answer.
Very well.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Zach Eichten. I work with the Minnesota Brain Injury Alliance as a public policy advocate. As Representative Nash, to your question about why this is being put in the pre-sentence investigation, this is modeled based off of the Veterans pre-sentence investigation and the Mental Health pre-sentence investigation. So this is a post-conviction bill, but it is designed to give the court that extra tool to be able to take that information into consideration. As Representative Munson said, when this bill was being crafted, we wanted to be sure that this wasn't going to be abused as a get-out-of-jail-free card. So having some sort of catch there that if there is a conviction this bill would provide a tool for a mitigating factor or diversion of some sort. To essentially what this will do is give the court that extra tool in looking at brain injury as a mitigating factor as well as the other stroke and FASD.
Very well. Thank you for the question, Representative Nash. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I am a co-author on the bill, and Representative Nash, that was exactly my question when I signed on, that it would seem to be better there, but hey, if we can get it done. I would like to point out that Cassie would have also benefited from Representative Edelson's bill yesterday as a mother, if they would have helped take that into account when they were sentencing her. 28 years in locked institutions. It wasn't until the last 4 or 5 that I realized how many of my clients were suffering from fetal alcohol syndrome. And there just isn't, without a battery of tests, it's almost impossible to detect. And but when I started applying the behaviors that the testifier just mentioned, the poor impulse control, the lack of planning, the not understanding consequences, it explained behavior. I mean, it just really explained what was going on. And so I think this is a really good bill. still would like to see it maybe done ahead of time so that we could divert them before they get convicted and into treatment. But this is a step forward, and I'm happy to support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm grateful to the testifiers, and especially Mr. Berry, who's been so valiantly bringing his experience around and trying to make sure that not only for your own daughter, but for other people too. And I thank you for that, and especially to Representative Munson for this work and recognizing the link and that we should not be criminalizing mental illness. I should note that I have quite a few concerns just about how the bill would work that I'm just trying to think through here. So one is just in that first paragraph about the one issue just relates to the idea of inquiring with every defendant. I wonder if, because of course there's in courthouses, this is happening hundreds of times a day. I wonder if maybe the intent would be to aim that more at felonies as opposed to in every single misdemeanor. That might be something to consider. And I guess maybe this may be a question for House Research, but if a judge does forget to inquire for every single defendant, that's in front of them, is there some, are we opening ourselves up in some way that there's something that gets, sort of what would be the remedy there for that? Because I just have that concern once you impose that requirement in every single case. If there's any comment, anybody, because I'm just not quite sure how that would work.
Well, perhaps I can drag counsel in just quickly on one of your questions, which is what happens if the court forgets, because obviously there are there currently are procedures and directives to the court, and so presumably there's some evidence of what has been occurring when the court does forget. But and I guess the question is whether there's anything in statute that speaks to that.
And Mr. Chair, it may not be necessary to answer right now. I know that it sounds like the bill's going to be laid over, but that's just a concern because at this point, with every single defendant, Mr. Meir and up asking about stroke, traumatic brain injury, fatal alcohol syndrome, then the concern is just to make sure that that if a judge does forget sort of how that works. I guess I'm raising a couple of different concerns there. Maybe that's something we can you, because again, the intent and the goal I'm certainly really supportive of. Sounds like the bill's author may have a comment, Mr. Chair.
And we're going to be holding on to this bill, so give us an opportunity to engage with counsel and then also to confer with one another. But Representative Munson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Pinto, that is a concern that I've heard from other members. I think Representative Stevenson brought up the same concern. Keep in mind this is after conviction, before sentencing, so it wouldn't overturn a conviction because it wasn't offered. This is something after conviction. But I'm open to amending it to figure out how we can ensure that people don't fall through the cracks. I also just wanted to comment on your praise for Mr. Berry valiantly bringing it around. It might be understating how strong he was in his words to people trying to get this done. And I also wanted to recognize Representative Considine's work with Cassie individually and helping her get her leg back and working with the prison that she's in now. Zach, did you have a comment?
Yeah,
very quickly, please.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative Pinto, this is based off the language in Subdivision 10 of this statute, which is the military veterans part of it. And in there, it's the same language where when a defendant appears in court and is convicted of crime, the court shall inquire whether the defendant is currently serving in or is a veteran of the armed services. I would assume that in the court proceedings, that would just be a subsequent question that would be asked, as well as what's already in statute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's helpful. And Mr. Chair, my more significant concern is at the bottom. I just want to confirm. So, to Representative Nash's question, I mean, if there are concerns that the defendant may have lacked the substantial capacity for judgment when the offense was committed, that is something that certainly should be brought up along the way. We would expect the defense attorney bring that up. And I think even the requirement under Rule 20 is if anybody has a concern about that should be raised all the way along. I guess the way this is written right now is I got a couple concerns that it's directed that if as a result of this information, the court finds the defendant lacks substantial capacity for judgment when the offense was committed, line 1.23, that's something that actually would remove liability for the offense in the first place. So really that's something that should be determined before the person's convicted, because sentencing is a little bit late to be figuring out the person should not have been convicted of the crime in the first place. I think maybe what this is aimed more at is diminished capacity, that this is something to be taken into account for the sentence the person receives. But if it is aimed at substantial capacity for judgment, then it certainly should be limited or have a connection with the existing statute, 611.026, and with the existing rule, because otherwise I would worry that the setup that's in there right now, which is a very extensive process to go through, it's called Rule 20, to figure out what the person has the capacity, this could serve to be an end run around that, and we'd want to make sure that it wouldn't be in that way. Maybe just my question for now, just something direct. I'm not sure if the author's spoken with the County Attorney's Association, the court, the state's judges, et cetera, but certainly we want to make sure to get input from all those groups before we would want to move forward on this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So I'm going to ask counsel to offer some thoughts here, and then Representative Monson, perhaps the question about other stakeholders that you may have interacted with. But first, I'll ask for counsel to offer some insights.
Mr. Chair, members, just a brief comment on the language related to capacity for judgment. That's lifted directly from the current Minnesota sentencing guidelines, and that is an existing piece of the Minnesota sentencing guidelines, which says, and I'm quoting here, the offender, because of physical or mental impairment, lacks substantial capacity for judgment when the offense was committed. That can be a justification for a downward departure under the sentencing guidelines. So that's where the language comes from.
Thank you.
Very well.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I can just to clarify with Mr. Johnson. And so it sounds like that is actually aimed at that as a factor that can be taken into account at sentencing, and that's what this would be aimed for then, if I'm understanding right.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, that's correct. It's as interpreted by Supreme Court, it's a slightly different standard than the 2002 inability to appreciate the difference between right and wrong, classic and not in standard.
Mr. Chair, mostly charging cases these days rather than handling sentencing, so that's a helpful reminder. And then I am curious just about stakeholders, if Representative Munson has any comment on that.
And before I answer, Mr. Munson, it is the Chair's intent to still take up House File 3411. There is no committee meeting after another committee in this room, and so I do want us to get through the agenda, so if we can be as brief as possible, be terrific. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll defer to
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto. We have reached out to other disability groups such as Proof Alliance in working on this bill, and we would love input from other groups who are concerned about it. I know that we met briefly outside this room, someone I'm forgetting their name, but they have brought up concerns about some of the specifics of it, and we're going to be reaching out to continue those conversations as well. Yes, thank you, Representative.
We've got some good work ahead of us in the coming days and weeks. Representative Johnson and Representative O'Neill, and then we'll move forward.
Chair Mariani, it's surprising I actually agreed with Representative Pinto this time.
Red letter day.
Yeah, I, the concerns I have is in Rule 20, it does take congenitive impairment into consideration. If there is a congenitive impairment, in the Rule 20 should find that. But also the public defender, when he requests one, or the prosecutors, they need to know about these things ahead of time. They can't throw them up at the last minute. And if there is an impairment that can affect, and so the person did not have control and actually have the proper judgment to know what they were doing at the time of the incident, that is a defense. That needs to be learned before the trial, and possibly get them the treatment they need quicker. And in the long run, it'll save money. This needs to be done at the front end, not at the back end, because the Rule 20 is for this purpose to begin with.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I also agree with Representative Pinto, which I often do, for the record. But I just feel like this bill just is not ready. The mechanics aren't right. The scope is too large. The cost is way too high. And I think it's duplicative, because I think you can get at assessing whether or not someone has some of these injuries without doing these extensive tests. I think you can look at previous medical history that could be provided by the defendant. I think there's other ways to get at it without breaking the bank of the courts. And I just think, as Representative Pinto has already stated, I think it's got some mechanical issues. So I hope we just put it aside and think about it, but I don't think it's ready.
Representative Neal, we certainly will have time to do that. And we are going to lay this over. I do want to acknowledge you know, Representative Munson's effort with Mr. Berry. You know, Mr. Berry's been around here for a few years now, and not a whole lot of us paid as close attention to him as possible. And I'm not suggesting anyone here is doing that, but obviously a very special and very difficult issue, and I do appreciate your effort. Okay. Representative Munson, to reach out and listen very carefully and see if we can craft something that responds. And it sounds like there's a will here to craft something even better and stronger than what's before us, and that's what this process is all about.
Okay. Thank you, Chair.
So with that, I do want to thank you, Representative Munson, Mr. Eichten, and Mr. Berry, and Ms. Messel for being with us here today. The Chair then lays over House File 1864 as amended. Representative Edelson moves House File 3411 be re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. And Representative Edelson, would you like to move the, I suppose you should, it's a DE. Representative Edelson moves the A20-0621 DE amendment to put the bill in the form she wishes it to be before us. Today, all in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. House File 2898 is the culmination of nearly 3 years of work by a large group of stakeholders organized by NAMI Minnesota. It included advocacy organizations, police, sheriffs, hospitals, county attorneys, counties, DHS staff, community providers, psychiatrists, psychologists, a person with a mental illness, a family member, and also the public defender's office. It operated by consensus, so even if one person objected to a change, it was not included. This is to make clear that there were changes that various groups wanted to make, but we wanted a bill that everyone could live with. The goal was to update the language, reflect that people are generally committed or provisionally discharged to the community, and to provide early voluntary engagement. We work to make sure people can receive the best medication to treat their illness, that missing paperwork doesn't lead to a commitment going away, and that mental health professionals have a large role to play under this act. There are a couple of things that this bill does not do. It does not change the current commitment standard. So it does not make it easier or harder to commit someone. We don't make any changes to what records are public or not public. There have been recent articles about the Baker Act in Florida where children are being committed. We do not do that in Minnesota. Parents consent to treatment in our state up to age 16, but commitment is rarely used, even for teenagers. I'm going to have several people who worked on this bill walk you through the changes. Please note that many of the changes are non-substantive. They are simply changing outdated terms, but it makes the bill much larger, as you guys can all see. I would urge your support for this consensus bill.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. Ms. Abderholm, good to see you this year in session.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Afterholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. And I'm going to whip through all these pages, at least the first third of them. So on page one, section one, we redefined community-based treatment programs to include all the various community-based programs that we have. It was pretty limiting before. One thing I want to mention is that the Commitment Act has not been substantially changed since before I came to NAMI, which was 18 years ago. A lot has changed in those 18 years, which is one of the reasons we wanted to update it. On section two, page one, we changed the definition of examiner to include all mental health professionals. Right now it didn't. And this would be for the purpose of placing a 72-hour hold on someone. So we can have a licensed clinical social worker, LMFT, licensed professionals be able to do the 72-hour holds. I will point out that court examiners, physicians, psychologists, and clinical nurse specialists are the only ones who can do the actual reports to the court. So we've separated those two things out. On section five, which is page two, we kind of fix this definition up of health officer. Health officer and peace officers are the ones who do the transport holds. And so we made sure that, again, we had all mental health professionals who could do a transport hold and a mental health practitioner who is on a mental health crisis team under the supervision of a mental health professional. So when they're out in the field and they see this, they can make that happen. Section six on page three, the definition of interested person was pretty broad, so we're limiting it just to people who have a specific interest. Section seven on page three, we really just made this more people-first language, and it wasn't like everyone with a mental illness needs to be committed, so we changed that around, but it does not actually change, again, the criteria for committing someone. On Section 8 on page 4, we included deputy sheriffs. Also, as on Section 10 on page 4, we don't have regional treatment centers anymore. We have state-operated programs. We wanted to use language that actually reflects what we have, so we made that change as well. On page 5, on Section 11, we expanded treatment facility to include all our current options, which include intensive residential treatment services and things like that, which were currently not included. Sections 12, 13, and 14 are all just minor wording changes, nothing substantive. Section 15 on page 5, we have we realized there was a small problem with this. We're all working on it right now. Nothing like a hearing to make everyone, like, really read the bill and say, oh, wait. And so what we wanted to do is to make sure that under a Jarvis order, someone could actually have a mood stabilizer, which right now are not included under the definition of neuroleptic. So we're working on that. So just know that's a change that we will be coming back with. Sections 16 to 20, again, are just wording changes to make sure we're including all the different types of programs and treatment facilities. And on line 7.15, we removed a reference to a repealed rule. On page 7, section 21, we added in a power of attorney and health care directives. We also clarified that when the head of a treatment facility or a state-operated program can give consent in an emergency situation, we're just qualifying it to say they can't be located in sufficient time. On page 8, section 22, we updated the language around ECT just to have it be what we call it now. On page 8, section 23, we added healthcare directive or psychiatric directive. On page 10, we just made sure that the treatment plan review timelines under Section 24 are according to the provider's license, because those are the rules that they should be following. On Section 26, page 11 through 14, this is a really important piece, and I wanted to say that this is voluntary. We're not requiring counties to do this. It's permissive. But what we get so frustrated with at NAMI is, you know, I take calls from family members and they say, my son has schizophrenia. We can tell that he's not taking his medication. He's starting to decompensate. And there is absolutely nothing that they can do until that person is a danger to themselves or others. And so what this would do, it would allow a county to do voluntary engagement. So it would have to be an adult, wouldn't do this for children. They'd have to have a mental illness. They'd have to start, you know, showing those symptoms. Perhaps they've been committed before, or whatever's happening could lead them to being committed or being in a hospital or a jail. And the county could send out what we're calling an engagement team. It could be a peer specialist. It could be someone from the mobile crisis team. Could be someone from the local agency. And they will try to engage that person in voluntary treatment. They'll make sure that maybe they have housing, do they have food. They'll really look at that person holistically. But we really feel like this is a way that we could get someone in early. If you've ever worked with homeless outreach workers, they're really good at developing that relationship with the person and getting them into housing. We want to do the same thing. Again, it's not mandatory. We think counties will do this, but we really think it's a way to really intervene earlier and not wait till someone meets the criteria for commitment. And this would go on for 90 days. We figure by the 90th day, either they're in treatment voluntarily or they'll probably meet the criteria for the Commitment Act. On page 12, section 27, we added health care directive and just some minor wording changes. Section 28 on page 13, again, minor wording changes, but we clarified that it's legal holidays. Oh, here's the voluntary section, sorry. On page 15, section 30, we updated the language. We clarified, we did the correct citations, and we moved some language to another section. Page 16, section 31, we just updated the language. Section 32 on page 16, children's collaboratives haven't been involved in the Commitment Act. So we don't know why they're there, so we took them out. And on page 17, section 33, some of the language just really didn't make sense because health plans don't often have treatment plans, so they're still going to have to pay for court-ordered treatment, but we got rid of the rest of the language. And now I'd like to turn it over to John Cohen.
Mr. Chair,
And members of the committee, my name is John Kerwin. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney in the mental health division of the office, which is the division that does civil commitments. I've been a participant on the NAMI task force and was involved in all the discussions and revisions that are being proposed.
Welcome, Mr. Kerwin.
Thank you. I'll start with section 34 of the bill. Ms. Abderholden admonished me to try to continue her pace in going through it, and so I'll do that. Section 34 of the bill on page 17, beginning on page 17, deals with hold orders, both the transport holds that are done by police officers and health officers, and then later hospital holds that are done. And I know the committee is familiar with those from the discussion that I just heard earlier. The current law in section 253B.05 has been very confusing to law enforcement agencies and to hospitals, who are the folks who are on the front line in implementing that part of the statute. And so we undertook to rewrite that section. Most of what's in section 34 just continues the substance of the old provision, but tries to put it out in a more understandable format. There are a few clarifications and substantive changes that I'll mention to you. One is on lines 17.26 and 17.30. The old law used the term injuring, so the person had to be in danger of injuring themselves. That was sometimes confusing to law enforcement because it suggested an affirmative act of injuring someone's self rather than simply being unable to meet the person's needs. And so this bill substitutes the word harming for injuring. There's a clarification beginning on line 18.4 indicating that if the health officer determines that the standard for a hold is met, that's sufficient authority then for a police officer to transport the person, to make it clear that the police officer doesn't then have to make his own determination about that, but can rely on the determination made by the health officer. The same line also adds the word examiner, which, as Ms. Abderholden mentioned, is a fairly broad term. And so an examiner could decide that a transport hold is appropriate. This might be someone like the person's community psychiatrist or other mental health provider. So just based on that determination, the police officer could transport the person. There's a change on line 18.20 indicating that the officer can transport the person, him or herself, but it can also arrange to have a medical or mental health transportation provider do the transportation. That's occurred in some places, but it was unclear whether it was specifically authorized. Another change addresses the duration of the transport hold. It was always unclear as to how long that authority continued once the person got to the hospital. So this law would say that the hospital has to make its own decision as soon as possible, but no later than 12 hours. That's when the authority under the transport hold would end. Another provision beginning on line 20.9 talks about when the 72-hour hold period begins. The current law says it begins when the person is admitted to the facility, but that often doesn't occur until the person has been at the facility for quite a while. They might be in an emergency room or a crisis center in the hospital. This makes it clear that as soon as the person at the hospital determines that a hold is necessary and is relying on that hold authority to hold the person, that's when the 72 hours begins. And finally, on line 20.9, in a provision that talks about a procedure for a person to go to court to contest the 72-hour hold itself, the current statute says that notice has to be given to certain persons of that court proceeding, but it didn't give them the right to actually participate. And this bill would make it clear that they would have an opportunity to participate in a hearing. Going on from the hold provision, on pages 21 and 22, you have three sections, 35 through 37, that really only contain technical changes. And so I'm going to go past those unless there are questions. Pages 22 through 29 of the bill, which is sections 38 through 45, address commitment procedures before the actual commitment hearing. So on line 22.29, there's a provision that says that in the pre-petition screening, there's a preference for in-person interviews with the proposed patient, if that's feasible. On lines 24.12 and 13, it says that when the pre-petition screening team makes its decision, that notice of that decision has to be given to certain people who are listed in the examiner's statement, which might include family and other interested persons. There's a change made in line 25.20, and this change is actually made in many places throughout this bill that I won't refer to, but it changes the term treating physician to treating medical practitioner, recognizing that unlike 20 years ago and 40 years ago when the statute was first enacted, we now have many kinds of medical practitioners, such as nurse practitioners and physician's assistants, who are carrying out some of these functions. Beginning on line 26.10, there's a provision that clarifies which county does the pre-petition screening when a case is referred over under Rule 20 after the person has been determined to be incompetent to stand trial. On line 27.22, there's a provision that says that when a county proposes to change venue of a case to another county, that the county that would be receiving the case has a right to receive notice of that and an opportunity to participate on that motion. Sections 46 through 49 on pages 29 and 30 contain provisions regarding the commitment hearing itself. There are a number of technical changes there. On pages 31 through 33, there are sections 50 through 53 that amend the statutory section addressing the court's decision and order after a commitment hearing. On line 31.7, it requires the court to consider assertive community treatment or ACT teams in deciding on the disposition. Beginning on line 31.11, there's a provision that discusses and authorizes what we refer to as dual commitments. They're already used in some counties, but courts other places have not recognized them as an option. And a dual commitment is a situation where the court will commit the person to a community provider, like a community hospital, but also to the Commissioner of Human Services in case that community placement doesn't work out. That enables many patients to receive their treatment right in the community in a less restrictive, less long-term setting. This provision would specifically authorize that. Beginning on line 32.3, the bill would change a limitation on the place of commitment in the statute. There was a statutory change enacted almost 20 years ago that added a basis for committing a person as mentally ill. And it said that a person could be committed not only based on their having failed to meet their basic needs, but also if the court determined that they would be unable to meet their basic needs. The reason was to not require that a person decompensate to the point that they've actually failed before they would be committed. But that provision contained a provision saying that such a person could be committed only to a local facility, not to a DHS facility. And because of that, and because community hospitals then and still are unwilling to accept a commitment if there isn't the commissioner as a backup, that provision was almost never used. And so this provision would eliminate that limitation in the statute. Almost all mental health treatment now is provided at the community level and not in state facilities. Line 32.17 clarifies that a person can be taken to their home at the direction of the court if the commitment petition is denied. Beginning on line 32.19, there's a provision that given that we have not just state hospitals, but a whole range of providers who might be the destination of a civil commitment, it clarifies reporting for purposes of background checks for different kinds of facilities.
Mr. Kerwin, I'm going to interrupt you at this point, and I'm struggling with this because part of this is Representative Edelson is, I'm trying to figure out how to disentangle issues in this committee for some of the mental health, or rather some of the health related issues. Obviously, there's a tight interaction with judiciary. This bill will be going to judiciary. It was heard in health policy. I know it's false, frankly, to try to separate all these issues out. Nonetheless, given the hour, and that we're going to be in session pretty soon, I'm wondering if there might not be a way to more quickly move through the more salient issues present before this committee, knowing that the health and human policy has heard this bill and that that other great committee, otherwise known as judiciary, will also be hearing it sometime soon.
Thank you, Chair. We have about 5 more minutes to go through the rest of the bill, but I don't, is that a possibility? Or?
That'll work. I just, well, again, I don't want to do violence to the need to fully air here. Just exploring whether or not there's a way for us to move a little more expeditiously.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Mr. Kerwin, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last section I was going to talk about is pages 33 through 39 of the bill. And this is the provision in the statute that deals with court orders and other authority to administer medications to people who are subject to the commitment system. And the change I would mention to this committee is that there's a change, and I'm looking for where it appears in the bill, but it authorizes if a person is under a Jarvis order and then the person ends up in a jail, it authorizes the medications to be administered to the person in the jail too under that Jarvis order as long as there are qualified staff in the jail to do so. And the rest of the changes to that section are fairly technical, and so I think I will leave those to the other committee that will be addressing this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Kerwin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sam Smith, and I'm the public policy coordinator with NAMI Minnesota. I will be going through the rest of the bill, and we'll only pull out 2 sections that I think are worth the consideration of this committee. The first is on in section 62 on line 44.26 through 44.29, and this stipulates that a civil commitment does not automatically end if 30, 60, 90-day paperwork is submitted. So this will, we think, will really prevent people from having their commitment end unnecessarily and will be really impactful. The only other section that I would identify is section 67 and 68. This makes some changes around transporting a missing patient, including a reporting of an absence that can be from any program. And then finally clarifying that the patient may be returned to another facility or program willing to accept the patient. And with that, I think that will cover the significant changes relevant for this committee. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Members, questions, thoughts? Representative Edelson.
Chair, one more thing. I think, do we have to move the A20 here? Mm-hmm. We moved it in health last night.
We moved the A20-0621D.
We did. Okay. Nice. I'm just making sure.
Very well. Anyone else that wishes to testify on this bill in the audience? If not, Representative Edelson, your final thoughts for us as we prepare to vote.
I just urge your support for this consensus bill.
Thank you very much. Members, Representative Edelson removes the motion that House File 3411, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and you are on your way, Representative Edelson. The members, with that, that concludes our work for today. This committee stands adjourned. Have a wonderful weekend, everyone.